Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 28, Tolkien and Rowling, What the Wizarding World Owes to Middle-Earth, Part 1, where we will be talking with Sara Brown and Amy Sturgis about the connections and divergences between these two iconic fantasy series. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. John, I know you're excited about today's show.
Boy, am I ever. We have the Tolkienites in Potter Punditry with us today, and as that's always a subject that I try to dance around, because the people who speak Elvish are very sensitive about getting it right exactly.
Of course.
I'm delighted to have the people that have written the best things on the subject here with us today.
Absolutely. We just have a spectacular lineup for you, listeners. Our special guest today is Dr. Sara Brown, an English teacher at Rydal Penrose School in North Wales and a professor at Signum University since 2012, where she is the MA Teaching and Thesis Coordinator and also teaches courses on Tolkien, fantasy, and fandom, including a course on Tolkien in Context, Middle-Earth as a Roadmap to 20th Century Anxieties. And I would totally love to take that course, by the way, Sara. Her PhD dissertation at Salford University was titled From Abjection to Alchemy in J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle-Earth Legendarium. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, Sara.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I think this is going to be a lot of fun. All right. And we are also joined today by Dr. Amy H. Sturgis, who, like me, earned her PhD in history at Vanderbilt University. She is faculty at Lenore Ryan University, staff at the Hugo Award-winning podcast Starship Sofa, and editor-in-chief of Hocus Pocus Comics. She has published scholarship on and taught classes dedicated to both Harry Potter and Tolkien's Middle-Earth writings. Her latest work on Indigenous Futurisms, and you can see our episode 4, I believe, on Indigenous Futurisms, that will be out next month from Peter Lang in the anthology Sci-Fi, A Companion. Welcome back to the show, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
We're going to get right into the mix here. This Tolkien-Rowling connection, you know, not only do they both have names that are commonly subject to mispronunciation, but also they have all of these little intersections that you can see at the superficial level. And as we probe more deeply, we can see that there's actually a lot that's going on with them. And there's some mysteries about to what degree Rowling has read Tolkien or not. And we are hoping to uncover all of those things today. So we're going to start with Sara. Sara, tell us, you are a Tolkien scholar. When did you become interested in Harry Potter as well?
Well, you know, I would love to be able to tell you that I became interested in Harry Potter from the very beginning, but alas, not really. I actually hadn't. I know, right? I didn't hear about Harry Potter until the third book came out, Prisoner of Azkaban. I don't know how I'd missed it, but that's when I first heard about this phenomenon called Harry Potter. And I heard about it from some of the kids at school where I was teaching at the time. And they said, well, you have to read these books. So I very sensibly went back and bought book one. And I thought, okay, I'll give this a go. Devoured it, went straight back to the shop and bought books 2 and 3, devoured those. And then I had that interminable wait for book 4. I know we all remember the long, long waits in between the books. So I only became interested in Harry Potter at around Prisoner of Azkaban, but I have never lost my interest in Harry Potter since.
Yeah, that's about the same time I got interested in it, and hence also the same time Amy got interested in it. Since I
thanks
pulled
her
to you. Into my world.
Completely thanks to you, yes.
So Sarah, just as a follow-up, do you think that the reasons that you were attracted to the Harry Potter books, that you devoured them, do you think those are similar to the things that draw you to the Tolkien world?
There are some similarities. I know that there's going to be some questions about, you know, to what extent is Rowling derivative? And I don't think she is particularly derivative. I think they both write incredible fantasy worlds. But that's what drew me to Rowling. Is one of the things that I love about Tolkien is that when you get into his secondary world, it is so beautifully created that you feel immersed in it. With Harry Potter, I instantly felt like I was in that world. I could see that world. I could feel that world. I could hear what was going on. I actually wanted to be in that world. And for me, that is what is the borderline between great fantasy writing and okay fantasy writing, or even not so okay fantasy writing, is your secondary world somewhere that I can truly experience within the pages of your book? Do I feel like you have, as Tolkien put it in On Fairy Stories, invented a green sun, and I believe in it? And for me, that's what drew me to Harry Potter, first of all, was the world felt so well put together. And then, of course, her characterization is so strong. You just follow Harry's journey. You are right standing alongside him wherever we go. And the way in which she wrote the characters made me feel drawn to them. So all of those things interested me in Harry Potter. And there have been numerous other fantasy worlds that have been written along the years that I have not had that instant draw to. I won't name names here, but because that's a long list. But with the Harry Potter world, for me, it clicked instantly.
Yeah, I think I had that same experience. And that's why I think you get a lot of them. We're going to talk about fandom later. You get a lot of people who they just want to live in these worlds. I think a lot of people are so attracted that that's a big draw. And the way that the world is evoked on the page, I totally agree with that. Let's get into talking a little bit about some of these questions of influence. And this is something that J.K. Rowling herself does not like to consider influence. And maybe it does come from her being pronounced derivative by so many people early on. And she looks like she's been trying to distance herself some from the idea that she might have been influenced by Tolkien. I'm saying that. I'm understating it. Am I not, John?
Woo-wee. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you just open the book and you've read The Lord of the Rings and you come across Butterbeer, you think Butterbur. You see the Dementors, you think Ring Race. You see the locket effects on Harry, you know, Ron and Hermione. You see the effect of the ring. There's Wormtongue and there's Wormtail, both traitors. You've got the giant killer spiders and Aragog and Shelob. You've got the magical mirrors, one of Galadriel, one of Mirror of Erised said, that are used as important props. You have Old Man Willow and the Whomping Willow. You have Sauron and Voldemort's deathlessness and their pursuit of an evil immortality, you know, sort of an ego immortality. You know, it's Maureen Lampson laid out all of these things ages ago at Hogwarts Professor. But Rowling is from 2000 on, she starts to back away any admission that she's got anything to do with the Lord of the Rings, largely. The speculation is that it was the appearance of Sean Smith's first biography, unauthorized biography, in which her first husband said that she carried around the Lord of the Rings everywhere with her while she was in Portugal, a one-volume edition, and that she revered the text. Rowling has done everything possible since then to dissociate herself from Tolkien's influence. which is understandable on a personal basis and on a professional thing because the Tolkien estate, but it's more that she doesn't like the what's always implied in questions about influence in these interviews is that she used him as a template and that she is only copying what he's doing, which is absurd. I mean, here's a man writing a myth for all Anglo-Saxon peoples in modern times, and here's a woman who is writing a parody, a pastiche of everything from Gothic novels to the schoolboy series. I mean, it couldn't be more different. And her treatment of it is clearly turning the thing upside down and around, as Amy has brilliantly shown about how Rowling changes all schoolboy novel tropes. So you're right. I mean, she says, she said, I read it when I was 14. And then she said, I read it when I was 19. I never read The Hobbit until the books were being written. It's like her thing where she loved the Chronicles of Narnia and then said, oh, but I have never finished the series. It's otherwise inexplicable other than Rowling's not wanting to be seen as a derivative writer when the influence is evident to anyone who picks up the books.
Yeah, and I think there maybe is some kind of, the question of what does influence mean? It may be misinterpreted, or that word may be interpreted different ways by different people. We're going to just ignore the ways that Rowling has tried to distance herself. although we want to talk about some of the divergences too, as you've pointed them out as well. But let's start by talking about some of the ways that they are connected together. Let's start with Amy on this one. Amy, I know that you wrote a very important essay that I always assign to my Harry Potter class. Harry Potter is a Hobbit, which is clear enough as an assertion of connection. Why do you say Harry Potter is a Hobbit?
First of all, thank you for assigning it.
It's a great essay.
Well, thank you. Obviously, no writer of fantasy, at least in the English language, can escape the shadow, right, the influence of Tolkien. But what I've focused on more, for example, in this essay, is how the Harry Potter series may be viewed as a successor to Tolkien's work, or how the series qualifies as what Tolkien himself called fairy stories, which was a genre he championed and believed had life-changing potential for adults as well as children. And there are quite a few ways that I looked at this, but two of the primary ways I think that Harry Potter as a series fits into Tolkien's tradition include, first, the themes of the works. And John's already anticipated some of this. Tolkien, I mean, there are a lot of themes that have very strong parallels, but the most important theme in both authors' cycles of works seems to be very much, compatible. Tolkien wrote in his letters that the main theme of his Middle-earth cycle of stories was mortality, and Rowling has said in many interviews that death is at the heart of the Harry Potter books. Both focus not only on what death means, but also how we should understand it, how we should behave toward it, and how the wrong-minded desire for deathlessness twists those who devote themselves to it. Also, I look at how, and Sarah has already referenced this, Tolkien's masterful essay on fairy stories, how he breaks down very precisely and carefully a definition of fairy stories. And that is a category that fits his own work. He's writing the example of what he's then providing the theory behind, and what gifts he believes fairy stories provide. And I argue that the Harry Potter series ticks absolutely every one of those boxes, and is, in fact, exactly the kind of story Tolkien throughout his life celebrated, defended, and urged readers to explore. So, touching on fairy, the perilous realm, sober magic, taking the magic seriously, involving human beings as characters, and touching on primal human desires, and offering the reader four life-changing and valuable gifts, fantasy, recovery, escape, and consolation. That's how he defines fairy stories, and I think that perfectly fits the Harry Potter series. So in a sense, I see Rowling's work as kind of a modern-day Inklings or modern-day Tolkienian project because it's fitting the definition of what he thought was so important in storytelling, what he himself was trying to write, and is also doing so with an emphasis on the same kinds of themes that Tolkien found important. That doesn't make it derivative, but I think it would make it the Harry Potter series something that Tolkien would have really appreciated and celebrated.
I think it's easier to see the Rowling Tolkien connection if you go further back and understand that both of them are making a critique of modernity using the pre-moderns. And especially the romantic school of Blake and Coleridge and Wordsworth, their whole idea of what it means to be human. And in reaction to Locke and Hume, they're making a critique in story through imagination, which as Lewis said about conscience, is continuous with the fabric of reality. And that one is a modern Tolkien and one is a postmodern, because of their love for Austen and schoolboy novels and all these genres that are born really in the reaction to the Industrial Revolution and the victory of empiricism. They're making this modern and postmodern critique of modernity in light of using the tools of the pre-modern romantics. Then you see Tolkien and Rowling really on board with the same project, an anti-modern project. And Tolkien simply being the scholar that got there first and talked about it, that both are engaged in the same work. And then you have Colin Manlove, who says, look, among these Inkling writers, basically Coleridge derived, be it through the Birmingham Oratory and Barfield and the whole set of Inklings that are they're Coleridge maniacs. Colin Manlove writes about the Inkling project as having two parallel streams, one that's conservative and one that's subversive. And Rowling is definitely among the subversive stream of writers in that tradition. And Tolkien much more the conservative. You couldn't think of people that were more different than a Vatican I anti-ecumenist Catholic and an Oxford Don, and Rowling the political leftist and ecumenist and a modern woman whose religious faith is Christian, yes, but of totally of an ecumenical brand in the Anglican tradition. You couldn't think of people that are that much different, but these streams run parallel in being a war with our modern individual rationalist understanding of ourselves and the world.
Sarah, you have also talked about this in your dissertation, then also that class that you offer at Signum University about the modern anxieties that Tolkien is displaying through his Lord of the Rings saga. And so I wonder if you could weigh in on this question of what Tolkien and Rowling are saying about modernity and if there's a connection there.
First of all, to begin with, Rowling herself and this idea of whether she's influenced by Tolkien, I think that's unquestionable, however much she sort of backs away from it. But there is a massive difference between being influenced by and copying. Rowling is not copying Tolkien. What is going on is, as you were saying there, they are both responding to modernity. They are both looking at the world around them and they are exploring what is going on within their writing. Fundamental differences, however, lie in how Tolkien is approaching the way in which he's looking at modernity. The way which I view Tolkien is, if you kind of picture a man standing in the middle of the 20th century, looking back over his shoulder longingly at times past, and then looking forward fearfully towards the future, and all the concerns that come with that. And the world that he's currently standing in is a world he doesn't recognize. And so when he's writing The Lord of the Rings, which of course he did over a very long period of time, what I see in his writing is a man who is attempting to engage with a very, very changed world. And all of the things that are happening in that middle part of the 20th century that don't feel like the same world that he was brought into, because it isn't. Tolkien is an Edwardian man. He grew up in a very particular England, eventually, of course, once he came back over from South Africa. And his experience of the world starts with being orphaned, continues into being sent away to boarding school, goes on into having to fight in the First World War and losing some of his best friends in it, and then goes on to sending sons away to the Second World War. And in between, the England that he is occupying is becoming so different that he doesn't recognize it. So here is a man who is troubled by the world that he is standing amongst, and so is engaging with it in that way. And you can see that in the themes that he's writing about. You're absolutely right that his primary theme is mortality, but a second primary theme is transformation, because if you look at the story of the Lord of the Rings, it is all about transformation. It's all about change. Now, if we look at what Rowling is doing, there is a woman who is standing in her spot in the 20th century and engaging directly with it. She is, I believe, using many of the themes and mythologies of the past, but she's not looking back longingly towards them. She's utilizing them to help her to create the world that she is writing about in the now. And when she looks forward, so into the future, there's a great deal more hope that I see in that writing than I see in Tolkien's. It's very, very different. I don't know, Amy or John, how you would respond to that.
It makes quite a lot of sense to me in the sense of the way that Rowling is looking forward and her thoughts about our agency in actually affecting change. I buy that. I buy that interpretation.
I would say that you're right. My only misgiving would be to say which one of them had a better view of things. I mean, to me, Tolkien comes off as has a bit, because he's experienced it himself, the transformation. He understands better what has been lost, and is much less a celebrant of the things which have displaced those things. Rowling certainly has some grasp of that, but that she's much more of a cheerleader for the changes than she is someone who is lamenting it. Again, the difference between a subversive and a conservative, I mean, that Tolkien is really somehow trying to point back to what was right and what has been lost, while Rowling has been trying to say that, yes, things today are very wrong. They're much too individually oriented. The whole idea of the Dark Lord's pursuit of a individual egotistic immortality compared to Harry's, which is about sacrificial love and his identity with what's most real. That's a critique of postmodernity and modernity, but she does it in a big celebration of all things postmodern. You know, she's taking on the meta narrative, but she's embracing that meta narrative.
If I may come back and just engage with what you're saying there, John, I completely agree with you. Because I do think that both authors are engaging with loss very directly, whereas Tolkien is, as I said, looking back over his shoulder and lamenting all the things that they have lost. And you have that pervasive sense of sadness that comes with all of the loss that you see within The Lord of the Rings. I feel like what's going on in The Lord of the Rings is that the characters are subject to the changes. With Rowling, she's agreeing that there has been loss, and that loss has taken place, but that the change is being effected by those within the narrative, that it is a positive change and that they're driving towards that change. And I think that's the difference that I see.
A class discussion that I had before the final book was out, before we had Deathly Hallows, and we were talking about the future for Harry, assuming he survived. And there was this big debate about what might happen to him. And one of the main points that came out of that was, well, remember Frodo, when he goes back to the Shire, he can't just resume his life. After being willing to sacrifice what he was willing to sacrifice, the normal life is no longer possible for him. And, you know, one of the students talking about this joked and said, it's not like Harry's going to, you know, when all of this is over, assuming he survives, he's not going to just go get married and have a bunch of kids and have a normal life. And everyone was like, exactly, that can't happen. And so I think that illustrates beautifully what Sarah's saying there, in the sense that, you know, Frodo was subject to and Harry, in a sense, made his future. It's a different ending note, and I think that hope that Sarah's describing is part of that equation.
You know, one of the things that you've emphasized, Sarah, and your conversation here is it's about the change element and the fact that things are changing, and sometimes rapidly and in ways that are uncontrollable or inexplicable. I think it's pretty clear that both Tolkien's Middle Earth saga and the Harry Potter books are very much about transformation. In Harry Potter, there's a lot of talk of transfiguration. And this is my segue into alchemy, right? Which is the science of transformation. John has talked a lot about the literary alchemy in Rowling's work. Sarah, you have seen a lot of literary alchemy in Tolkien's work as well, and how this is, you know, trying to depict some of the transformations that are occurring in his own time. So, Sarah, can you help us to see where can we find literary alchemy in Tolkien's work?
Sure. Well, first of all, I have to send a round of applause John's way, because I would never have engaged with alchemy in Tolkien's work if it hadn't been for John's work on alchemy in Harry Potter, because my starting point was looking at the level of transformation and change, because, as I said, it is one of the major themes of the work. And then I was given a copy of one of John's books on alchemy in Harry Potter. And it was like click, 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 everything fell into place. So thank you very much for that, John. And so my beginning point was in that sense of transformation, which, as you said, is occurring in both Harry Potter and Tolkien's work. And I was looking at the works of Carl Jung along with this to help me to understand how Tolkien appeared to be engaging with alchemy. And Jung said that nothing changes anything else without itself being changed. And that, to me, is at the heart of what is happening in Middle Earth. Changes everywhere, because you even hear it from Treebeard. In Treebeard's own words, he says, I feel it in the water, I feel it in the earth, and I smell it in the air. So if you're going to have a look at the way in which the whole world is engaging in constant transformations, then it lends itself to this idea of literary alchemy. And it begins actually in the Silmarillion, all the way back at the beginning with Tolkien's creation myth in the Ainu Lindale at the beginning of the Silmarillion. And if you read Solarius's work, Harmonia Microcosma, which was published in 1660, and that's looking at the music of the spheres, which is that creation myth where you have this music that is at the start of the world, and the way in which the spheres are moving together and the music is occurring to create the worlds. And that is very much what is happening in the Ainu Lindale. You actually have music as part of the creation of Tolkien's world. So that's the very beginning. And then I started to see all of the elements of alchemy within the way in which he constructed the books of the Lord of the Rings. So if we begin with the Fellowship of the Ring, to me, I read mostly the Nigredo stage here, which is all about the breaking down of the early matter in alchemical terms. And if you think about it, this is exactly what's happening in the Fellowship of the Ring. Things are beginning to break down in Frodo's world in particular. You think the Shire is this idyllic, protected, static place where nothing will ever change because nothing ever needs to change. And with the intrusion of the ring into that world, which, of course, is brought there by Bilbo in The Hobbit, and an understanding of what the ring actually is, change becomes apparent immediately and things begin to break down. You also have a lot of Tolkien engaging with the idea of darkness and blackness within the Fellowship of the Ring. Simple things like, of course, the Black Riders, but also the Dark of Moria, for example. So you have that sense of the Fellowship of the Ring being that breaking down of the world that has been what Frodo always thought of as being this idyllic and beautiful world, into a world of uncertainty, where you have to leave your home, you have to go out into the big wide world, where you're only a small person, and carry with you the most dangerous object in that world and try to destroy it. Otherwise, your world will be destroyed. So that was the first stage. Then looking at the Two Towers, here we move into the Albedo stage, which is that second stage of where everything could change, anything could happen, because you've moved past that initial breaking down, but you're nowhere near the resolution as yet. And this is signified usually by white and water imagery. And if you look at the Two Towers, there's so much imagery involving water and white that it starts to become almost like a tick box exercise reading it. You go, oh, look, lots more white here, white here, and lots more water. And it you have to be very careful not to start applying tracing paper onto it and saying, oh, look, there you go. There's the Albedo stage. Tick, move it along. But there's so much there that I started to feel like this cannot just be coincidence. There's so much here that reads alchemically. And then you move into the Return of the King. And here we have the final stage, the Rubedo, which is usually signified with fire and blood and the color red, and is the resolution of the matter, where in alchemical terms, you have the vessel in which you are making the substance, which you hope will become the Philosopher's Stone. And this is the resolution of that matter. And it's so very clear in The Return of the King that you have all of these images of fire and blood and redness all the way through it. And you do get the resolution at the end. But it's not quite as simple as that, because although there is a resolution to the story in that the hobbits return to the Shire, they scour the Shire, they get rid of Sharky, they put everything back to rights and all is well, it is not well for Frodo. He has to return to the Albedo stage because he is not ready. He is not done. He has to actually pass out of Middle Earth so that he can become fully transformed, so that he can, again, in alchemical terms, die to himself and be reborn, be remade as the living equivalent of the Philosopher's Stone. So there's all sorts of these transformations going on. I mean, I could go on for even longer, and you'll just have to stop me because, you know,
no,
I have got hours of this stuff.
Stop her.
Don't stop me. I can carry on.
What a beautiful meta narrative, though, that for the whole series. That's just beautifully put and concisely put as well.
I was rereading Sarah's, you know, magnificent thesis this morning, especially the chapter on alchemy. And I was thinking that she's talking about Frodo's need to return to the white work, the Albedo. And that is in keeping with Tolkien's Catholic beliefs. I mean, basically, he has to go through purgatory because this purgation is sort of just implicit in Tolkien's understanding of the afterlife. So that here's a person who's been damaged and suffering. As much as he's an embedded character in the story, Tolkien is looking forward to his own white work, as it were, in the afterlife. But that this is framed, though, in alchemical symbolism, and the set of symbols is, through Dr. Brown's work here, really unavoidable. Those of us who have been bombarded with questions about alchemy for 15 years now plus, this contribution is so welcome, because all the work that had been done with alchemy in Middle Earth was in a wild, off the wall book by a man named Shelton, and this is to right the ship. To me, the alchemy, the question is, you know, do you think Rowling learned this from Tolkien? I don't think so. I think both of them have learned it from their close reading of, again, these pre-modern works that Tolkien is in on board with people that are, you know, Charles Williams is an alchemist himself. You know, that this is something he gets from his everything from, again, the Birmingham Oratory to his all of his friends in the Inkling set. Rowling gets it from her study of astrology, of Dickens and others, that it's implicit in the English tradition. But how they both use it so successfully is that it's not in your face. I mean, it's how I talked about it. Mm-hmm. You're hitting tick boxes like, oh, here's another thing like that. And you get that when you start looking through the books and you try to find it. But it's embedded so artfully in both works that it never strikes you as being, here's the alchemy. Nobody will miss this.
Casual reader doesn't pick up on it. If you're just reading through, you're not even going to necessarily notice.
Well, yeah, and I've got the scars to prove it. You know, I asserted this back in the day. Sorry, very, very, very nice about how it's become sort of a commonplace in the critical literature. But back in the day, I was scoffed at by the academics because it was preposterous that Rowling was using this subliminal artistry inside what was one critic who called it, you know, this is Billy Bunter on broomsticks. This is not Shakespeare and Dickens and Yeats and Lewis and Tolkien.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, John and Sarah, is that, you know, literary alchemy, it's very complex. You know, there's a complexity to the kinds of symbolism and it's thematically tied, of course. And I wonder if some of the maybe early resistance to talking about literary alchemy with these two series has to do with some of the scorn that people heap upon fantasy literature sometimes.
I hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right.
They think it can't be that complicated. It's just a children's book, or it can't be that complicated. It's got elves in it, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is the transformation that many of our listeners may not be aware of. Tolkien today is considered to be a giant of 20th century literature. But all three of us Rowling Tolkien wonks, I'm going to include myself as an ancillary part of that guild. We remember when Tolkien was dismissed and despised as a children's book writer. Now Tolkien is considered to be the more serious writer, and Rowling still suffers as the way Twilight suffers now in comparison to Harry Potter. Certainly Harry Potter suffered in comparison with Tolkien, and Tolkien before that suffered in relationship to Joyce and the so-called literary novel.
And ironically, that ties back to your earlier point about Tolkien's relationship to modernity, because he points out in On Fairy Stories that this relegating of fantasy literature to children was one of the outputs of that modernist turn, the industrialist turn, that before that, these kinds of imaginative, speculative stories were considered for all audience members. And that it's at that point where people say, no, this is just kid stuff. And he even goes off and says, in the same way that H.G. Wells was criticizing what industrialism did in terms of class in The Time Machine, that ultimately in The Time Machine, you end up with two classes of people, the Morlocks who live in the dark and get nothing good and run everything, and then the Eloi who live in the light but are vapid and empty and do nothing. He said that's what they've created out of adults being Morlocks and children being the Eloi, who are never given anything challenging. But the worst part is that the Morlocks never get any light. And he said, that's what you've done to readership by taking works like fantasy works and just giving them to one segment. And then saying that fantasy can't do anything like challenge or even cause the growth of morally or intellectually or imaginatively children. And so he's all this is all connected, you know. And so in the sense, if you point out that he's reacting against modernity, he's also challenging the idea that this is kid stuff and that adults don't deserve to be challenged and moved and transformed by it as well.
Absolutely. I think, you know, you're preaching to the choir here on that, and I think to our listeners as well, the transformative power of fantasy novels. I think we would all be on board with that. One of the points that you had made, Sara, was that both Tolkien and Rowling, another sign of their complexity and their value, has to do with the world building and the convincing world building that they do. And a lot of that is drawing from the land of myth in both cases. How should we compare the ways that Tolkien and Rowling use mythology in their world building?
I think that we're all aware here of the extent of Tolkien's personal education. He was incredibly widely read, but he was also expert on Anglo-Saxon, and he read Anglo-Saxon myths, Icelandic myths. He read extensively the poetic Edda, the prose Edda, Nordic myths, you name it. And he was also incredibly interested in Welsh mythology. And he was quite clear on how he was drawing on all of the main aspects of these stories to help to create his world, not just in plot line. You know, you have a hero's journey, for example. So not just in quest, which you also have, but in language and culture and the way in which those inform the world that he creates. One of the things that I find most extraordinary about Tolkien's work is that, for me, his secondary world lives and breathes because he starts with language and culture. So he creates the language of the elves, for example. In fact, he creates two, and then he decides how they would behave, how they would live around that language. So he creates the culture to go with it, and then he creates the story that goes with that. So it's a bit like looking at, why did Esperanto as a language fail? And Esperanto as a language failed because it had no culture within which it was truly embedded. For Tolkien, he embeds his language within cultures. He uses that to flavor his world. And then he's drawing on mythology to pair in with all of those things and create the stories within the whole story of The Lord of the Rings. So that although you have this kind of quest story, Frodo gets ring, Frodo travels to Mordor, Frodo fails to throw ring into volcano, ring goes into volcano, all happy, Frodo goes home. You have many more stories than that going on. So we meet different peoples, and each of those peoples have their own culture and their own story and their own history. And that informs the way in which they are behaving and responding to the crisis of the ring. So you have the elves and the way in which they respond to it. You have the hobbits and their response to it. But you also have the Rohirrim, who are people who seem straight out of mythology. And you have the Gondorians as well, and all of their different ways of being informs how they respond to this massive crisis in Middle Earth. So for me, with Tolkien, he's fully engaging in all of this mythology to the level of actually creating languages that feel that ancient sense, that make the world that he creates feel like it actually exists.
You know, one of the things that I'm struck by based on what you said, which that is really fascinating. I hadn't thought about that before, that the language is the starting point. I think that Rowling, and I accept challenges from all speakers here, but Rowling is not inventing a new mythology in the same way. She's not really going so far back as that. She is actually instead making deliberate references to mythologies that are already embedded in our current day culture. And John, you and I just did a podcast with Evan Willis on the mythological connections in Harry Potter. What do you think? Do you think that's a fair enough statement?
Yes. seriously, unlike Tolkien studies, which are relatively well advanced, the idea of Rowling as weaving myth into a new mythology or a new structure is very recent. Evan Willis at University of Dallas is doing a lot of this work. We have known for some time that, for example, that Harry Potter is in many ways a rewriting of the Orestes myth. It's certainly got a hero's journey embedded inside of it. I mean, you can do the same thing with, you know, that Sarah did so wonderfully with, you know, here's the 10 sentence summary of The Lord of the Rings. Every Harry Potter novel is Harry escapes from Privet Drive. He arrives at Hogwarts. There's a mystery there. They're out after midnight underneath the invisibility cloak. You know, Nancy Drew and the two Hardy boys, and then it comes to a crisis. Harry makes a saving people decision. They go underground. They meet the bad guys. Harry dies and near death, rises from the dead in the presence of the symbol of Christ. Harry escapes like a good Gothic heroine, and we return to Privet Drive via the Hogwarts Express. I mean, this is every single book follows that formula, hero journey with Rowling's changes to it. But the core myth is Orestes. You know, that you got this guy with a scar trying to avenge the death of his father. And now we have in the Cormoran Strike books, we've got Castor and Pollux and their story against the Leucippides, the white horses. I mean, this is Rowling's thing. And the fascinating thing to me is how much we're learning about this. We didn't know, for example, that one of Rowling's first teachers was a man named Steve Eddy, who is not only written books on Greek mythology, but it was a professional astrologer today. And that we're finding out how much she was not a classicist in terms of studying Latin and Greek, but she was a classical studies major who was studying Greek myth in depth and boasted in a University of Exeter alumni bulletin that she had more books on mythology now than she did when she was in school. So this is a living dynamic concern for her. But back to your point, Katie, the big difference here is that Tolkien is a world builder. I mean, he's quite consciously building a mythological structure, as Sarah has pointed out, in all of its dimensions, individual, social, theological. Rowling isn't doing that. She's doing an intertextual transformation of a mythology from which she says she borrows shamelessly because English mythology is already a shameless mishmash. It's an entirely different scope of a venture. They both understand mythology as archetypal literature. They're bringing people in contact with a much greater reality through mythology, but they have different scopes of artistic creation, and they have, in a way, different ends. Rowling is trying to recreate Greek myth in large part. Tolkien, not at all concerned so much with Greek mythology as with Nordic and Icelandic mythology, but trying to engage people so in their transformation the way myth does.
And I was thinking about the sort of Greek orientation of Rowling compared to, you know, the more Nordic orientation of Tolkien as well. Amy, what do you think about all of this?
Well, first of all, I agree with everything that's been said, but I think you pointed out something I'd like to follow up on a bit more. There is another layer to Rowling besides the deep undercurrent of how she's anchoring the larger Harry Potter story to myth. And this is all tied to the fact, as John pointed out, they're doing two different things. They're writing two different kinds of fantasy, in a sense. Rowling is writing wainscot fantasy, in which our present-day mundane world butts up against the magical world, and there's cross-pollination. So this also allows... We can't get there from here in terms of Middle Earth, right? It's a different age. We've inherited texts like the Great Red Book of Westmarch, but those are the closest we can get to interacting with Middle Earth, whereas we can actually experience potentially the wizarding world. And that allows Rowling to kind of gleefully show her characters acknowledging and interacting with mythological influences. So, for example, you know, Harry and Ron reading about various mythological characters on their chocolate frog cards, or the Weasleys visiting the pyramids as a nod to Egyptian mythology, or the trio, you know, encountering a modern day Cerberus from Greek mythology in the form of Fluffy, the three-headed dog. But there's a lot of winks and nods there to the audience, right? Hagrid got him from a Greek chappie. In a sense, the way you can teach, or the way you can think about, or the way you can explore Harry Potter can also be following these kinds of clues. They're not so subtle, right? Tolkien's borrowings, as Sara's pointed out, you know, Finland's Kalevala and Iceland's Eddas and Beowulf and all these things, that's subtly embedded. If Tolkien's leaving breadcrumbs for us, at times Rowling's just throwing the whole loaf at our heads, you know? But that's a gift, I think, that of the kind of fantasy that Rowling's writing, because it is that wainscot fantasy where we can go back and forth, where these two worlds are butting up against each other. She can appreciate we know what she's doing, and she can have the characters flat out acknowledging some of these things. And so, yes, it's most definitely anchored to a larger mythological game plan or outline, but there's also all of these little gifts along the way that are popular culture, cultural literacy exam, you know?
So we've been talking a lot about the connections. We've been talking about them in tandem and also doing some comparison and these questions. But why ultimately, why bother comparing them? I guess is my question. What's the significance of tying these two things together? You know, does it matter, the similarities that we see between them? What can we get out of that?
Quick thoughts on this. I think that if there are connections, and I believe we agree that there are, imply that Rowling too is worth taking seriously, that the Harry Potter series has the potential to have serious staying power, intergenerational, you know, staying power that will outlive the kind of Rowling moment when we're still expecting new material to come out, in the same way that Tolkien's work has shown this sort of intergenerational staying power as a kind of modern day classic. I also think the connections imply that Rowling's work, like Tolkien's, will not only be adapted and expanded, but also readapted over and over again as people explore why these relevant connections speak to different people at different times. And we should kind of banish the idea of having definitive adaptations. That's already happening. Creators are going to continue to reimagine, to go back to speak back to. And I'm here when I'm saying creators, I also mean fan fiction writers and fan artists and other fans who do sort of immersive work, that they're speaking back to what happened before. And that's healthy and that's good. And it doesn't erase the original texts, so just chill, people. but these are going to be works that we're going to be in continual conversation with, I think. And not to end this on a downer note, but I do think comparing the two and finding connections is also instructive about the limitations of their works. Hmm. Just one example, and this actually speaks a lot to your work, Katie. Tolkien intended his Middle Earth cycle of stories to provide a mythology for England. That's pretty defined parameters. He just did it so very well that it ended up speaking to the entire world, right? Mm-hmm. But Rowling's original seven Harry Potter novels were also British-based, although, of course, she gave little glimpses of the wider wizarding world. These were kind of tantalizing peaks, but they weren't really fleshed out. And even though she is drawing from classical sources, she's also writing from her own culture and her own knowledge base. And I think that now she's expanding her storytelling through the Fantastic Beasts stories to what's really a truly global stage. Her tales are not nearly as effective or successful as stories, in large part because I don't think she recognizes or has humility about the limitations of her own perspective. And Katie, you know this much better than I do about sort of the colonialist, imperialist mindset, kind of undercutting or at least being in conflict with her own craft and her own message. And I think that's instructive, too, from a critical angle, to see how they have or haven't contextualized or put parameters on their own works, because those connections allow us to see how brilliant both of these creators are, but it can also lead to some useful, fruitful criticism about their works as well.
Have you left anything for the rest of us? That's excellent. So, and I totally agree with you about, you know, looking at the authors and the limitations of not only their work, but like the worlds that they create. And that reminds me of what I was thinking of in answer to this question is about that conversation that we had earlier in the podcast about what Tolkien is saying about modernity and what Rowling is saying about modernity. And there are different approaches to that that are yet very connected, very tied together. And I don't think that you necessarily get the full picture until you look at them together in that way. And, you know, what Sara was saying about that and what John said about the conservative and the subversive differences in their approaches. I mean, to me, I just think that that brings light to both works because you have, you know, you've just put them side by side. And I absolutely hope that you're correct. I mean, I think the Tolkien scholarship has gotten a boost in the United States anyway. You can offer a Tolkien class in a college without, you know, any disdain. And I hope that the Harry Potter scholarship is also going in that similar direction.
One, you know, again, always making some sort of genuflection in Amy's direction to her brilliance. But yeah, to build on that earlier point about modernity and the conflict that both these authors have with the tenets of modernity, Rowling is writing about writing and reading much more, I think, obviously than Tolkien is. She's really talking about the importance of the reading experience and getting the narrative correct. There's always a narrative misdirection inside the stories. There's always the struggle to get it right as how we're supposed to understand either the text we're reading or how the characters are misreading or reading correctly the text that they're struggling with. Rowling is talking about, ultimately, I think, what human capacity we have that is reading and tying it to something which is magical or at least not materialistic. It's not rational. It's a super rational faculty. It's transpersonal. It's implicit in their capacity to do magic, that speech causes transformation in the world, that there has to be some conjunction between words and reality. They're both after essentially the pre-modern view of man, which is that he has this spiritual transpersonal capacity called imagination, as Coleridge and company do, or conscience, or the nous, the intellectus. This is the pre-modern anthropological and psychological understanding of what a human being is someone who purifies that capacity within us, which is not really us as individuals, but is our link to what is most real. Both of them are about the purification of that faculty through a reading experience. Hence the alchemy, hence the chiastic structures that both use. All of these things are to support that purification of those things. And in that respect, you know, Tolkien and Rowling are at war with our current understanding of what it means to be human and advancing it through the story. And the success of both books speaks to the human longing for oxygen, for that capacity that they provide inside their stories. Hence the Iliadi thesis about, you know, these books are as popular as they are because they do best what we want books to do. That is, you know, to give us an alternative to the disenchanted world of the so-called Enlightenment, and to give oxygen to our capacity to transcend ourselves. That Tolkien is the man who sets up the bulkhead, the barrier, the point of resistance to all those things, and that Rowling stands atop that barrier is why we should bother looking for Tolkien's influence on Rowling.
That wraps up part one of this episode on Tolkien and Rowling. Stay tuned for part two, where we will continue our conversation about the commonalities and divergences between the Wizarding World and Middle-earth, including the intersecting fandoms and the movie adaptations of these imaginative works. Thanks to our guests, Sarah Brown and Amy Sturgis. John Granger, I always appreciate your expert perspective. I'd also like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thanks for all you do, Emma. And as always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999, and our MuggleNet producer, Laurie Beckoff. Speaking of which, dear listeners, we are glad you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And again, please stay tuned for part two, where we will continue this discussion. And now, listeners, I leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it. We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic."